This is Sting.
Susan Sarandon.
Russell Simmons.
I reaffirm my belief
in the value of basic human rights.
I believe that no one should be attacked,
imprisoned,
tortured,
or killed.
As a citizen of the world,
I believe that we each have the right,
the responsibility, to stand up to hate crimes of any kind.
To make the world a safer,
more peaceful place. It's up to you,
me,
us, to join millions of Amnesty International supporters right now.
Call 1-800-AMNESTY.
Or visit www.amnestyusa.org.
World-famous recording artists and actors are using their voices to speak out for human rights and to encourage the rest of us to join them. There is no better time than the present. This is the Human Rights Report from the University of Arizona's chapter of Amnesty International. I'm Asia Philbin. In our last report, we talked about the International Monetary Fund and human rights problems associated with it. Today, we will go into more detail on the other side of the new economic order, trade. But first, we want to tell you about some recent human rights news. The U.S. State Department decided to certify Colombia's compliance with human rights conditions, despite the fact that they have made no progress towards meeting them. By law, the State Department must certify Colombian government on three human rights conditions before releasing military aid. The conditions consist of five main provisions dealing with civilian court jurisdiction, suspension of military officers, compliance with the conditions by armed forces, cooperation with civilian authorities, and prosecution for paramilitary activities. Three international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, the Washington Office on Latin America, and Amnesty International, strongly object to the U.S. decision, citing Colombia's failure to make even minimal steps to meet these conditions. For example, Colombia has not shown that they have taken action against paramilitary groups. In fact, all illegal armed groups continue to target, mainly civilians. Many human rights workers have already been killed this year. Additionally, Human Rights Watch America's director, José Miguel Vivanco, points out that the Colombian military still retains ties with a known terrorist group. Previously, in August 2000, President Clinton had waived human rights conditions for Colombia. In other news, the leader of the main political party in Myanmar, Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, has been released after 19 months under house arrest. The current military government, the State Peace and Development Council, has faced increasing international criticism over its poor human rights situation. Since December 2000, the government has released about 280 political prisoners, and arrests of political dissidents have declined. However, over 1,500 political prisoners are still imprisoned, including those who have already completed their sentences. Meanwhile, back in the United States, the Bush administration withdrew its signature from the Rome Treaty, which established the International Criminal Court. The U.S. supported the concept but did not want American political leaders to face prosecution by the court. That's the human rights news for now. I'm Asia Philbin. Next, Jesse Bangu will finish our report on world trade, globalization, and human rights.
Intercommunity trade in general dates back to the Stone Age, but the affected society did not always view trade positively. Early trade often followed forced entry into unwilling markets and sometimes dealt in undesirable products such as weapons or drugs. More recently, international trade has been portrayed as a more natural system. However, economists still disagree on the value of free trade or trade liberalization, in which countries can trade goods with fewer restrictions. Throughout human history, countries commonly charged an extra price on imported goods to protect local industry. While trade liberalization is actually a modern idea, free trade, including the concept of the most favored nation, was first formalized by the Anglo-French Trade Liberalization Agreement of 1860. This agreement led to market-driven laissez-faire trading, but was riddled with hidden political agendas and thinly veiled attempts to increase corporate profits at the expense of workers. Since the agreement undermined the concepts of free trade, a reactionary wave of trade protectionism followed, which lasted into the 1940s. As we mentioned in the previous report, after World War II, the Bretton Woods discussions established world trade as a main objective of IMF policies, as many viewed free trade as an integral part of globalization and the new economic world order. After lengthy debate, global consensus settled on a plan of tariff reductions and free trade. This new multilateral trade agreement was called the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, or GATT. It came into force on January 1, 1948, among the 23 countries which controlled two-thirds of the entire world's trade. But after GATT lowered tariffs, nations found that they still preferred the old trade barriers. This discontent grew into a major conflict following the oil crisis of the 1970s. Nations gave up on GATT and regularly broke its rules. Most observers assumed it was finished. But then, large corporations developed an interest in global markets. They, along with the economically powerful nations, applied enough pressure to revive GATT, but in a new form. On April 15, 1994, in Marrakesh, Morocco, 110 countries signed a new agreement called the World Trade Organization, or WTO. By January 1995, the new WTO began and would eventually replace GATT. The World Trade Organization sets trading rules between nations with the mandate of promoting free trade. It is the only organization responsible for making multilateral trade agreements between its members, which include most of the world's trading nations. Despite the initial promise, controversy developed quickly, starting with the least developed member countries who complained about lack of representation, even though they outnumbered the wealthy nations. To dispel arguments that it is controlled by its most powerful members, the WTO claims that it has never had to resort to an actual vote to resolve any matter, as they reach full agreement among all members through consensus. They advertise their democratic process, publicizing a provision in which individual countries who disagree with a decision are not required to abide by it. In general, they feel that most complaints about their processes are based on misunderstandings, including environmental, labor, and human rights concerns. The Director General of the World Trade Organization, Michael Moore, went as far as to state that the WTO was the world's leading organization promoting these very issues. One WTO delegate hypothesized that the World Trade Organization could have avoided World War II if it had existed then. He claimed that lack of such an organization allowed Hitler to rise to power. However, many WTO opponents, including non-governmental observers, see these public statements as meaningless rhetoric. For example, consider the claimed fairness of the WTO decision process. Since it is not open to the public scrutiny, we do not know how much influence powerful nations hold over developing countries. Also, despite their claims, a member who disagrees with a decision must abide by it or face economic sanctions. They continue by reasoning that in a zero-sum game like world trade, if some countries, usually the powerful ones, gain economic strength, then other, weaker countries must bear the expense. Also, they dispute the value of a transnational decision-making body that has the authority to subvert any country's internal democratic process. That is, WTO decisions may bypass local laws that hinder trade, even laws that protect the local environment, labor, or culture. Critics see this as a threat to the sovereignty of member nations. Until December 1999, the WTO remained anonymous and claimed the quiet support of the world. They plan to meet in Seattle, Washington to introduce a new millennium round of trade agreements. But even its own members could no longer deny the strong public opposition to their plans when over 100,000 protesters took to the streets, severely disrupting the meetings. As tensions rose, the meeting chair, Charlene Barshefsky, imposed a forced discipline on the delegates. At this, the tensions turned into full conflict, and even attendees began to publicly condemn the proceedings. U.S. news downplayed the problems. Local Seattle television portrayed demonstrators as a gang-like, violent threat to local citizen safety, and the police as protectors of the overwhelmingly supportive public. But foreign media had a field day, quoting outraged WTO members in their headlines. The fiasco had become an international embarrassment to the United States, and even President Clinton had to call for an early adjournment. Finally, Barshefsky announced that the meetings had collapsed, putting an end to the disaster. Afterward, observers said it was one of the worst setbacks of Clinton's presidency. The World Trade Organization tried to deny the problems and claimed the early termination of the meeting was normal, but the problems were too pervasive to be denied. One member of the U.S. negotiating team, James Clausen, openly admitted that the protesters succeeded in their goals. Even Director General Michael Moore admitted, quote, deep crises existed within the organization. delegates confirmed that they failed to meet their objectives, with some calling the meeting the worst ever. Specifically, they complained about the lack of a clear agenda, Michael Moore's weak leadership, and Charlene Barshefsky's obvious and abrasive promotion of the U.S. agenda. The Trade Commissioner of the European Union, Pascal Levy, admitted that the protesters had affected the meeting and that the WTO needed to address their concerns. However, despite these problems, the WTO did not attempt any significant reform. According to a special report dealing with the subject of trade and human rights, in August 2000, the United Nations Subcommission on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights received a report condemning the World Trade Organization for their negative impact on human rights. The two human rights experts who authored the report, Joseph Olaka Onyango from Nigeria and Deepika Udagama from Sri Lanka, called on the WTO to review its system of trade liberalization, bring human rights out of the periphery and directly into the decision-making process. The authors called the existing WTO rules, quote, grossly unfair and prejudiced. The report also focused on the increased influence of corporate interests on world trade decisions over human, social, and cultural rights. With the rise of the global economy, large multinational corporations moved production to countries with lower labor costs. They could negotiate the lowest wages among nations with the highest unemployment. These countries were so desperate for the jobs that they actively competed for these companies, effectively losing any leverage to advocate labor rights. But the companies made the situation even worse. Once the labor pool was in place, they reduced wages even further, since the workers had no negotiating power and were easily replaced if they organized. Out of this kind of background, oppressive company policies resulted in unregulated sweatshops which violated workers' rights. We normally associate sweatshops with manual labor, but recently we have seen globalization give rise to skilled labor sweatshops, such as with computer programmers. But even aside from the cheaper labor pool, the corporations also benefit from relocating production to poor countries when they do not have to pay for environmental protection there. These companies are so large and provide so many jobs that they strongly influence local governments and can coerce them into making decisions against their own nation's long-term interests, including their local environment. Finally, large corporations have power as sponsors. The media is not immune from corporate interests who may wish to filter entertainment or even the news to prevent any negative images from reaching the public. We will look at media bias in more detail in a future series. But corporations have more direct power than just through the media. In 1995, Royal Dutch Shell demonstrated this power when environmental activist Ken Saro-Wiwa was executed in Nigeria. Saro-Wiwa was an outspoken critic of Shell's oil operations, which threatened the Ogoni people of Nigeria. Shell denied direct involvement, but was linked to financial support of their military dictator, Major General Sani Abacha, through taxes and royalties. Many human rights activists blame Shell for indirectly supporting repression and the killing of Ken Saro-Wiwa. But following the death of General Abacha, some political prisoners were released, inspiring some hope for the future. In general, human rights activists are trying to work with large corporations to show them that it is to their advantage to abandon oppressive policies of the past, take the side of the people, and to work towards greater freedom and justice. This concludes our look at globalization and human rights. It also concludes this series of human rights reports by the University of Arizona chapter of Amnesty International. I'm Jesse Bangu. Amnesty International is an independent human rights organization working for fair trials, ending torture, abolishing the death penalty, and freeing those who have been in prison solely for their beliefs.